Hello, it is Oliver Wang here, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. I'm sitting in for Guy Branum, who couldn't be with us today. And with me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, we have the Lean Trio today with author Margaret Wappler.
Hello, Oliver.
Hello, Margaret. And special guest Flynn the dog, who seems to be here. I believe Flynn is here on a very apropos day.
Yes, Flynn was really needed for this show in particular. He's going to be our lifeline to the animal world once we get to our main topic.
There we go. And we have Pop Rocket's favorite fifth beetle, Karen Tongson.
Oh, hey there, and hello, hello. I figured I'd fill in for both
everyone.
Winter and Guy, since I don't have my own trademark greeting yet.
You gotta work on that, Karen.
Yeah, we'll
next time you get here,
I'll figure it out. I've thought about it, but you know, whatevs.
So coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about celebrity pets, and we can take that term a lot of different ways. Again, hence why Flynn is here to represent the pet world. Plus, we will each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's discuss what arts and entertainment news and events have caught our attention this week. Me and Karen are both going to talk baseball. So actually, let's start with Margaret and a new show on HBO. And I feel like I can't keep up with all the new shows on HBO.
Has been a very heavy onslaught this fall. Insecure is another one that I thought about talking about, which is really wonderful.
Has it already debuted?
It has. Okay. Second episode I saw.
Just came out this past weekend.
Last night.
Yeah, and of course,
a couple nights ago.
There's Westworld. And now Fleabag.
So Fleabag is a 6-part comedy series that's on Amazon, actually, not HBO, but it feels like an HBO show.
Oh, my bad.
No, it's okay.
Because there are British people on it? Feels like HBO.
Yeah, and it's smart and intellectual and edgy and all that kind of stuff. So it's based on a play by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and she plays the main character, Fleabag, who is this very witty, acerbic, dark, dysfunctional woman who we see in London trying to run her very sad bakery and also navigate the London dating world, even though she also has a boyfriend in the picture who she's on and off with again. And the thing that's so amazing about this show is that Phoebe Waller-Bridge is like a real powerhouse performer. She does this thing where she will talk to the camera and kind of say things that are a secret between herself and the audience. And then a split second later will deliver possibly even the same line to a different character, but in a totally different tone. So you get this whole range of emotion from her, where a lot of times she'll say what's socially acceptable to the other person, but in her mind, she'll say the really dark thing that we're all thinking. And it's so satisfying to see this kind of actress play almost like this Jekyll and Hyde kind of character. She's dark. She's a woman who is in some ways not likable. And I find that really compelling as well, because as we know, like often women can't be anything but likable and cheery on television. So it has so many merits to it. And I really suggest watching it because it's hilarious. It's dark. It's spiky. It's really good.
It's pretty great, though, to be able to have a woman or a female character do a kind of Jekyll and Hyde rangy thing without it having to be linked to a particular pathology, like United States of Terror or something like that, which, you know, it's just like, oh, somebody has MPD or it's another Sybil thing or what have you. It's just this kind of daily tuness of being a woman moving through the world and doing British things like having a sad bakery.
Right. Like, there's no diagnosis at play. She's just a person like all of us who thinks one thing in our minds and then says the thing we're supposed to say out loud. Two, as just an actor, showcase it's really great. Like, she's got mad skills. Like, it takes a lot to have that kind of discipline to, like, deliver a line in one way and then a hair second later deliver it totally differently. Like, it's great.
Kind of on a side question, but I feel like with Amazon, with their high-profile returning shows, they give it a lot of marketing push. So, like, you know, the new season of Transparent or something along those lines. I feel like their new shows that are sort of out there to test the waters just sort of randomly land. And it's like, oh, there's a new Amazon comedy that's, you know, maybe highly acclaimed, but we only learn about it after the fact. And Amazon doesn't seem to put a lot of push into saying, why don't you check out this new thing? Unlike, I think, Netflix does a much better job of promoting some of their kind of so-called original content.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if Amazon is just such a huge albatross of entertainment and media that things like Fleabag get lost quite easily in there. I think I've seen some really positive reviews on it. Places like Vulture have definitely been singing the praises. But, yeah, I don't feel like it's quite caught on. It's not in the zeitgeist yet. But, again, it might just be because there's so much fall TV. There's so much to catch up on. Yeah. I do think this is one of the – this is like a sleeper that hopefully will gather more acclaim.
Is it a half-hour or hour-long comedy?
Half an hour.
In six episodes.
Yeah.
So very short season, really.
Yeah, and it's – I mean, it is based on her play. And you feel that theatrical energy of it in the best way. Mm. And watching it, I was actually like, okay, maybe I should check out more theater. You know what I mean? Like, there's something about it that I know. There's something about it that has that, like, wild, crackling energy of the best kind of theater you can see, where it really does play with the sort of schismatics of how, what would you, like, the fourth wall, right?
Yeah.
Like, that kind of energy of, like, playing with the fourth wall, it has that.
Karen, so both you and I are about baseball, but... Unlike me, who I'm being very fair weather at this point, because all the teams I typically root for, which either be the Red Sox or Giants, have both been knocked out. You are a true blue Dodger fan.
I am a true blue.
So I'm going to let you. I'm going to let you talk about baseball first.
Well, okay. So I'm a true blue Dodgers fan. I became a Dodgers fan when my family moved and settled into Southern California in 1983, when I was 10 years old, and I remember. I don't know what it was about baseball. Maybe it's because it was on all the time that became a thing that I cathected onto. It felt like very much a part of my new immigrant experience.
Right.
And I totally, you know, especially the 80s Dodgers, because they were winning so much at the time.
Right.
And with the presence of somebody like Fernando Valenzuela on the mound.
Right.
So, I mean, I even wrote like a fan letter to Pedro Guerrero, who played third base like in the 80s. And I got like I still have his autograph photo that he wrote back to me.
Nice.
In any case, and of course, you know, as a young, like, proto queer, budding lesbian, baseball, softball, whatever, right? Those two things are simpatico. What I found about this particular, well, first of all, the Dodgers, anybody who knows anything about baseball knows they tend to always win the division, and they end up in the NLDS, especially in the last several years, the National League Division Series, and they always bite it.
Right.
In a pretty unceremonious way.
Right.
And they were on the verge of doing that this time around, but they came back and won this tremendous Game 5 in the NLDS.
On the road.
On the road in Washington, and with Clayton Kershaw coming in to save the game after throwing 110 pitches the day before.
Which he hasn't done since he was a minor league player.
Yeah.
This is not a usual task that is he's called upon to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, I mean, I'll always key into what the Dodgers are up to, like, all season, but especially in October. I call October the month of my Dodger blues, usually, because it's turned out that way for a long time, and they haven't won a World Series since 1988. I still have my 1988 World Series Dodger shirt that I wear to every game.
Nice.
And I wear when I'm watching every game. But one of the things about it this particular year is it allows me to really kind of sublimate all of this shit that I have around, like, the election and competition
and
all of this kind of noise. And kind of delight in, I don't know, a game with fair play. And this is part of, like, linked to, but this is also linked to the
other
thing.
What do you mean the game is rigged?
Exactly.
Obviously.
The game is totally rigged.
We're not supposed
and this
to talk
is part
about
of why I also, like, one of the pop culture things I wanted to append to my conversation about baseball is that it coincides with the kind of emergence of this new series on Fox called Pitch. Which I guess I think you and Winter and your guest, Sarah, I can't remember her last name, talked about this show on your fall TV.
Really briefly.
Briefly. But it's about, you know, what happens when the first female major league pitcher comes into, you know, the league. And it's a super gratifying sports show. Kylie Bunbury is the lead. And, how can you not like a show with an actress whose real last name is Bunbury, like, especially if you're into Oscar Wilde like I am. And Mark Paul Gosselaar as the kind of aging, wizened catcher with a big beard is perfect. I didn't think that, you know, he would have some great revival that, like, utilized his skills in a particular way, but I guess this is the perfect thing.
Wait, where would I know him from? Or should know him from?
Saved by the Bell.
Oh.
Ding,
yeah.
Ding.
Ding, ding. And you know, he's part Indonesian, too. He's one of those secret Hapas. In any case, the show is – so it's gratifying on a sports level, and it's gratifying, again, as a point of sublimation for all of this stuff that, you know, I'm thinking about with the election and gender and competition and the pressure that, you know, kind of high profile female feels. The parts of it that are disappointing to me are really all about how much of the story, number one, with any sports story featuring a female athlete, has to totally like make sure to establish how straight she is from the very beginning. Mm. And so that already kind of the ghost of an ex-boyfriend comes and factors into the first couple of episodes, who she played in the minors with. And
it's like, and there's
a, yeah, there's like a lot of, yeah, exactly. There's a lot of family drama involved, but still all of the kind of workout montages are really great. My friend Jennifer Doyle has a real great read of this as a kind of romantic fiction. But I'm like in it for the montages and the music and the cameos from real players and the last game, last episode, which was about the All-Star game. So it's worth a watch, and it's a nice companion piece to the actual baseball that's happening. Mm.
I did see Pitch on the fall television schedule, but it's weird, and I've never really been able to piece this apart. But I think in terms of sports, in which I really enjoy sort of the backstory behind the scenes qualities, that's really basketball for me. And so I will follow the career travails of different basketball players in a way that I just don't have the same investment with baseball or football for that matter. But what I love about baseball, and the reason why it's my thing for this week as well, is because we're in the postseason now. There's been some phenomenal games, ends of games. And I think for just as a pure sport and the kind of human drama that's involved in, you know, with a pitcher facing off against a batter, and with, I was thinking,
Kershaw versus Murphy.
Yeah, which was how, bottom of the ninth, you know, the game five ended when the Dodgers were beat the Nationals. You know, this was sort of Kershaw's ability to exorcise his postseason demons, because he's had a lot of very disappointing years. And, you know, if he messes up, Dodgers are out again. It just adds to this narrative that the Dodgers and Kershaw are always going to choke.
Chokers.
So, I mean,
yeah,
there was so much writing on those pitches. And the thing that really reminded me of why I love baseball so much is that the rhythm of the game isn't dictated by a shot clock. And that's very different than other American pro sports. It's just one person throwing a ball and someone else trying to hit the ball. But that can go on and on. You can keep fouling it off. There's not a predetermined ending to it. So you never know when the resolution is going to happen. And that moment where, especially in the game that we're talking about, I think that the ball was hit to maybe second, grounded to second, and they
infield
threw it out.
Pop,
right. And it's one of those things where that the minute you hear, the moment you hear the crack of the ball against the bat, and you don't know what's going to happen there.
Especially on TV, because you don't see the arc of the ball or anything like that. So you're like, oh,
wait, what's about to happen?
Yeah.
And this, the sheer deliciousness of that drama is something that, again, I love, love postseason baseball. And it doesn't really matter to me that my two main teams are out. I can still enjoy the quality of the game for the quality of the game. Yeah. And certainly as an LA guy now, like, I'm perfectly happy to see the Dodgers go through. I'm kind of empathetic to long-suffering fan bases. So if the Cubs go all the way, like, I'm not going to be mad at that.
I was going to say, all the Chicago people on my feed, of which I have many being from Chicago, are like practically rubbing gems and doing rain dances, like anything they can do to make this happen.
Oh, I have a lot of superstitions. And in fact, whenever Sarah, my partner, always asks me, like, you know, are you doing that because, and I'm like, you're not allowed to talk about it. You can't ask me about it. You know, to
right,
the point
can't
where,
jinx it.
You know, exactly. But now I have to switch up my routine for the NLCS versus the NLDS. One more thing to say about Pitch is that I know that I'm dragging it back.
Oh,
there,
no,
but,
it's fine.
But to a certain extent, it was inspired by a true story of a little leaguer, Monet Davis.
Yes, right,
who
right.
pitched, the first female to pitch in the Little League World Series, to pitch a shutout.
Yeah.
In the Little League World Series. And so it's sort of, you know, the question is like, it's not a matter of ever, it's a matter of when.
Right.
And actually now Davis is playing basketball. She realizes that, you know, she doesn't have a lot of pro options in the future in baseball. And in she's in high school now. That's how young she was when she did this. And now she's a basketball player. But in any case, I just wanted to add that as a kind of, you know, historical link.
Right.
To something like Pitch.
Well, again, maybe it is a question of when. That when might be a long time in coming, but hopefully it will come at some point.
Yeah.
You are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about celebrity pets after this.
Mugs, shirts, stickers, patches, tanks, and more are yours for the purchasing at maxfunstore.com. Hey, you already love the podcasts, so why not take this to the next level and outfit your home and bod with our merch? MaxFunStore.com. Because if you have to wear a shirt, it should be one of ours.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum. And with me in the studio are...
Karen Tongson.
Margaret Wappler and Flynn Wappler Earl.
So here we are to talk about celebrity pets. And when we were first batting around this topic, Karen asked a very good question, which is, so are we talking about pets owned by celebrities or pets and animals who themselves are celebrities? Mm-hmm. And I believe the answer to that question is yes.
All of the above.
Margaret went out and in true, you know, journalism background check mode, found some amazing factoids about pets. I don't know if we're going to have time for you to run through all of these, but what were some of the gems that you gleaned here?
Oh, God, so many good ones. I mean, I had a good time just reading about artists and their pets. Frida Kahlo, for instance, had many, many insane pets. Multiple pet monkeys, Mexican hairless dogs, parrots, parakeets, macaws, chickens. This is my favorite. She had a pet eagle named Gutrudis Cacablanca. I think we all know enough Spanish to translate that effectively. And a fawn named Granizo. So, I don't know. Like, there's a great precedence with artists, celebrities, actresses, all sorts of famous people owning pets. I mean, also political pets, that whole realm.
Right.
I just sort of, like, before we move off the artists having pets thing, just wanted to say before we continue this conversation that a really dear friend of mine, now Bustamante, who's an artist and who was on the first season of Bravo's Work of Art, just lost her dear companion species, Fufu Rufu, the poodle, who's also featured not only in many of Now's performances and works. Now's actually now the dean of the USC Roski School of Art, but Dean of Vice. In any case, Fufu is a very dear figure who figured so much into our queer art worlds, who's been in films. She was in Valencia, the film adaptation of Michelle Tee's novel Valencia.
Oh, nice.
She's got a great IMDb page, and I just wanted to acknowledge that because this just happened recently, and I know it's really tough for someone to lose their animal familiar.
Right.
So
we probably should have begun with a simple question just going around the table here in terms of how many of us consider ourselves pet people. Now, I mean, Margaret literally has her pet sitting in her lap,
yeah,
so I think we already know the answer. Did you grow up as a pet person?
Absolutely. My parents had multiple pets. I had, when I was a little kid, we had in the family rabbits, mice, a cat, a dog, multiple dogs, actually, multiple cats. So I honestly don't feel right in my life unless I have a pet. Like, I just have to have – I've had cats in the past. I've switched over to team dog as an adult because I finally was mature enough to take care of one.
Which is real. I mean, that's real.
That's real. That's real. And I do say, like, in your 20s, do not get a dog. I mean, unless you really are devoted to walking it and all that kind of thing. But cats are better for you. But, yeah, I would definitely say I'm a pet person 100%.
And I think anyone who follows Karen on social media, you post a lot about your two cats.
Lily and Corky. You can follow them on Instagram. They have their own Instagram account. They're at Lily and Corky Show, L-I-L-Y and C-O-R-K-Y. In any case, yes, I too always grew up with pets. It was a little different. The relationship that people had to pets in the Philippines is very different to the way pets are treated here in the States. And so, I mean, I had my first kitten when, you know, I was like 8 years old in the Philippines. And I had a dog. So, like, I kind of, you know, I'm a switch hitter here with cats and dogs.
I feel you.
I had a dog, like a puppy who was a total, like, third world street dog, completely mangy. Like, but, you know, we got him from a neighbor and we brought him. He immigrated to the United States with us all
first
the way from
generation.
Manila.
Did he have to be quarantined?
No, not at all, actually. And nice. In fact, his little kennel thing, when we flew, we had to stencil the words immigrant onto his little
cage.
That
is amazing.
So, but yeah, Charlie, rest in peace. So, you know, so I had dogs.
I had a dog named Charlie as a kid.
He was like a sort of like, you know, he looked a little like a black lab, but like kind of this third world street dog version with a curly tail.
Nice.
But in any case, so my family had dogs here. I mean, and there, I think a friend once described cats or having cats in the Philippines as like, catalytes because they just kind of radiate around the house and you kind of feed them outside. I think that there's a certain way that my parents still replicate that because they've actually built a refuge for the stray cats in their neighborhood in their backyard with like misters. I mean, it's insane. My family is basically, we're insane, crazy pet people, mostly cat people, but my parents have both cats and dogs.
So I did not grow up with dogs and cats in the house. We had, you know, goldfish that didn't last very long. I had a hamster that was really a part of a science experiment, which I ended up selling or giving to a classmate of mine in middle school. And I think it had babies and then it ate the babies. That's something very dark.
Yeah, that's very dark.
They but, do that a little too much.
Yeah.
I had a hamster who did something very... Yeah.
Unspeakable.
Yeah,
hamsters.
It's unspeakable. I can't go there.
But no classic dogs or cats, partly because my mother, the ever pragmatist as she was, just felt like pets lowered property values. And so I did not grow up either as a child nor in my 20s having a pet in the house. But me and my family inherited an ancient cat. Max is at this point, I feel like 19 years old, which I think is like 300 years cat years.
That's
really, really,
really
old.
I had an 18 and a half year old cat.
Yeah.
We
inherited him from my sister-in-law when she had to move and didn't allow pets in her new place. So we've now had him for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And it's, as someone who's not really a pet guy, I'm perfectly happy to share my domicile with Max. I find Max semi kind of endearing, but the sort of like the ways in which I know other people have relationships to their pets, I'm sort of like, this is just sort of like a stranger that I'm kind of cool cohabitating.
Like a roommate.
Yeah, exactly.
Your boarder.
Right.
Your Craigslist roommate.
Yeah. I'm wondering at some point, did I just miss this window where I could be a proper pet person? I know, you know, my daughter Ella will certainly grow up and you know, when Max goes, and it's going to happen at some point, you know, she's completely trying to, pressure us to get, you know, a replacement pet of some sort.
As she should.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm just like, I don't know. I mean, it was nice to have him around. I'm already talking about him in the past tense. So it's very, very disrespectful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that says a lot, Oliver.
Max, shut your ears.
But yeah, maybe one can be a born-again pet person later in life. But I'm still sort of in that ambivalent, like, take it or leave it phase. But it is nice having, as my wife would put it, the trust of a small animal around. I understand the appeal of that.
It's true.
To bring this back to celebrity pets, you know, one of the things that in looking over this kind of master list of things that Margaret looked up. So, for example, Miley Cyrus has a kitty named Shanti Om BB, apparently.
That is correct.
Taylor Swift has a cat, Olivia Benson, that's named after the character on Law & Order SVU, which somehow makes me like Swift less for knowing this for whatever reason.
But I love that she named a cat after Meredith Grey.
I also like it when pets have normal person names, you know? Like, yeah. I had a cat named Phil at one point, and like, Phil worked in an office. Do you know what I mean? Like, Phil had a different persona than, like, he wasn't fluffy. He wasn't Spot. Right. He was a man who worked in an office.
Just as a kind of anecdote, our neighbors had a cat that would come to my parents' house, and her name was Nicole, which was also the name of the kids who named her stepmom. So it's like Nicole the human and Nicole the cat. And that always flipped me out. Like,
well, this, can I bring up the fact that Kylie Jenner has a bunny named Bruce?
Yeah.
And that she got this bunny named Bruce, like, right after Bruce announced himself as Caitlyn Jenner.
I'm sure it's just a coincidence.
Yeah.
I mean,
like,
there are
bunny
layers and layers layers to this.
Yeah.
I think part of the thing that I've noticed about, you know, how celebrity pets, the pets that belong to celebrities, enter into the news is they always seem to have this effect of I don't know if humanizing. I guess maybe it is. It sort of humanizes celebrities through, like, non-human animals. And you had mentioned very briefly a moment ago, Margaret, about sort of presidential pets. And I was thinking that no matter how much we might dislike presidents, we never seem to dislike the presidential pets. Like,
no way.
Like Nixon was bum, but Check, who's going to be mad at Checkers the Cocker Spaniel?
Well, Checkers rescued
Nixon's
political
career. He warmed Nixon up
a
couple of times.
Or Sox, which was Bill Clinton's cat. You think about Bo, the Portuguese water dog that the Obamas got. You know, I guess the true test of this is depending on what happens in about a month or so, what the next presidential pet's going to be. We'll have to look at the Q rating for it, like whether it's Clinton or Trump. If they have a pet, do we like the pet or do we hate the pet as an extension of the person? But what is it about pets that sort of works, it tickles our hearts when it comes to sort of celebrities that we might not like otherwise, but knowing that they're a pet owner somehow, you know, we're more game with them for some reason.
Well, you're responsible enough to obviously take care of a creature who's dependent on you. That's one thing, right, ostensibly.
But that doesn't work with kids, though. Like, kids don't necessarily make celebrities more likable, but somehow pets do.
Yeah.
It is interesting that kids don't necessarily have the same cachet that pets do, but I think it's pets are also about empathy. Like, you know that the person who owns that pet likely has some kind of empathy. And I think now it is in vogue, too, for these various celebrities to get a rescue animal.
Oh, yeah.
Not to get a purebred.
Lena Dunham's dog was, you know, she's posted a lot about, I can't remember his name right now, but, like, he's definitely, like, the fact that he's a rescue features in frequently to her social media.
Because if they
posting.
Don't, they get completely blasted. So, yeah there's
right.
that, too.
Like, you have to rescue the most, like, sad, like, tripod mutt dog from the streets, you know, yeah. and give it a home. Like, I was looking at Ariana Grande's pets, and, like, you know, she has a whole, like, saga on her page about, like, what her little doggy has been through, and I think that's like it's a PR move in a certain kind of way. It does humanize them. Mm-hmm. It does make them more empathetic. What am I trying to say? It makes all of us feel close to them. It's relatable. You know, Bush, when George W. Bush was president, I couldn't be politically further from him. But the fact that he loved his little Scotties, that warmed my heart.
Well, I feel like it's no longer politically correct in the post-Jolie Pitt moment to just gather children from different parts of the developing world.
Right.
And
they're...
therefore now, like, you know,
wait,
that
that's just
there, it's like,
that
you know,
suggests
that
there was
happen.
A moment where that would have actually worked. I'm not sure there was that moment
well,
ever really existed.
I feel
existed.
Like actually, I mean, in the Sally Struthers, like, for the price of a cup of coffee, like, era, you know, that was, you know, seen as a more noble, you know, kind of empathic move. And so the... You know, like, I think that the move, the empathic move, or the thing to, like, telegraph empathy now has to do with the rescue pet, because at least it doesn't get you into hot water with dealing with all of these kind of actual, like, kind of human structures of dealing with each other.
Like some sort of cultural...
Yeah.
I don't want to say appropriation, that's not the right word.
But like a kind of a cultural imperialism, or just the kind of philanthropic... elements of colonialism that there always were, right? Sort of like, you know, feed a starving child in China, kind of like that. There are starving children in China, like, you know, that kind of rhetoric from the 70s and what have you, or starving child in Africa, or like the USA for Africa, like all this humanitarian stuff. And in fact, like, it's not that those efforts are no longer needed, but in terms of like a quick PR fix, it seems like it's far less problematic to grapple with, like, having, unless you mistreat a pet, right?
Yes.
Which Bieber and his abandoned monkey in Germany is like one example of, right?
I did not know about this. Oh my God.
Yeah. 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 So there's this whole controversy around Bieber and, you know, bringing
monkey.
One of his, like, I can't. I'm
but how do you abandon a monkey if you just leave it where it was?
Well, because, yeah.
I mean,
because,
that's probably better
because
for the monkey, right?
He didn't check into the kind of quarantine travel laws that were involved, and he was just like, late's monkey, you know, and it was
peace out,
yo, love you, dude. And then people like animal rights activists flipped out about this. Yeah,
I mean, I think that adopting a rescue dog is like the most apolitical, just shining moment of humanity kind of move that you could do as a celebrity.
Let's now switch to talk about pets and animals as celebrities. And again, Margaret, you actually wrote a very long thing about Laika, the Russian cosmonaut dog that was launched into space in 1957. What is it about the saga of Laika that just draws your attention?
Laika really breaks my heart. So Laika was a Russian mutt picked up off the streets of Moscow when Russia decided to launch Sputnik 2. And they wanted to basically see if an animal could survive in space. And they launched it into space, and there was no exit strategy, let's just say it that way. Laika was not going to come back, and there was no plan for her to come back. And when people got wind of this, I mean, one thing that's really fascinating to me is how the different cultures reacted. Mm-hmm. Like, the papers in Britain, for example, were like, oh my God, what are you doing? You can't kill a dog. You can't sacrifice a dog to our, like, space travel fantasies. But And Russia said, no, 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 we do love dogs. We do love dogs, but we have to see this is a sacrifice. We're going to do this. So, and they actually lied about how Leyka died for a long, long time. Oh, wow. They said that she, you know, lasted a while and that she was humanely somehow put to death. I don't really know the details of how they explained it, but recently it's come out that she actually died within a few hours of takeoff. Like, she just was overheated, she panicked, and she died.
Oh.
So that is a very, very sad story about our first Russian cosmonaut dog. But the story that I researched that is much more happy is the one about Belka and Strelka, who also were from the streets of Moscow. Two mutts. They were picked up. They were launched into space in 1960. And clearly by then, just a few years later, Russia had gotten the idea that, yeah, you know, maybe we should have them come back healthy and alive. So these dogs came back. They orbited the Earth more than a dozen times before landing the next day. And the thing that's so interesting about Belka and Strelka is that they have a long lineage that connected to America. Basically, Strelka, before she passed away, she gave birth to a puppy named Pushinka. Awesome puppy name. Come on. And Khrushchev.
That is a great name.
You know, Pushinka. I can, yeah. Like, it's very satisfying to say.
My next child. I'm definitely going with Pushinka.
Ella and Pushinka. Yeah. Khrushchev, the Soviet premier, gave Pushinka to John F. Kennedy and his family. And Pushinka's puppy went to go live in the White House. And they renamed her Fluff.
Which is so whack.
So whack. Yeah. I mean, you had a name like Pushinka, and you're going to call it Fluff? Please.
Well, that was a political moment, though, demanding a non-Russian
exactly.
name.
Exactly.
This is a total tangent, though it's still connected. Have either of you ever been to the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Culver City?
Yes, and I love it.
No, you know, it's one of the L.A. things, the one of the few L.A. things I haven't done yet.
You would adore it, number
you
one.
You would yeah. be crazy for
it's
it.
It's very difficult to describe the museum. Some people call it sort of like an anti-museum or a very meta-museum. I'm not going to even ruin what makes it so awesome. I will say, though, that they have an amazing and impressive series of classically painted portraits of Soviet space dogs the museum, including, I'm sure Leyka has to be there. I'm sure Belka and Strelka are, you know, get some love there as well. So if for no other reason, you should go to the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Culver City, California, to look at their Soviet dog portraits.
You can still see Belka and Strelka taxidermied, of course, at a Russian museum. I believe in Moscow.
You
can peep those guys as alive as they're ever going to get in your lifetime.
Also, just a quick update on Bieber's monkey.
We needed this.
Real time update. A capuchin
monkey, and now Molly has become a German citizen and has been adopted by the Germans. So
Molly, M-O-L-L-Y?
M-A-L-L-Y, Molly.
Oh,
maybe.
He totally meant that as a hint towards Molly. Come
so
on.
Now he's been transferred to an undisclosed German zoo.
See, and this kind of, I think, really plays into the ways in which...
German zoo.
Yeah, that sounds actually a little bad.
That sounds ominous. Yeah, very.
But I think it's like an undisclosed German zoo is probably better than Life with Bieber.
Sounds like Molly went to a rave and never came back.
I think it also reflects the very kind of liberalized immigration policy and refugee policies that Germany has.
Yes, it's true.
See, in Britain, they would have that monkey would have been gone.
That monkey would have been so gone.
Right, right. They would have Brexited
that monkey.
Brexited the monkey.
We should bring this back to sort of like animals in Hollywood, but in a moment, because Karen, you have this also a great anecdote about this Japanese dog that is enshrined outside of Shibuya, which is sort of one of the big neighborhoods in Tokyo. You want to talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, sure. So Achiko is one of the world's most famous dogs. The story of Achiko has been like remade in film multiple times, so it links to popular culture in various ways. But Achiko belonged to a professor of agriculture named Isaburo Ueno, and from his puppydom to the age of two. And one of the things Achiko liked to do was to accompany his master to the Shibuya
train station,
the subway station. And so every morning, Achiko would go and then return when Ueno returned from teaching, right, for the day. It's the same exact train schedules every day.
Right.
Well, 2 years into their friendship, Ueno suffered a massive brain hemorrhage while at work, and he never returned. But Achiko kept going back to the Shibuya station at exactly the same hours every day waiting for this master to return.
And my heart is just
kind
breaking.
Of emblematic I know. Of a dog's loyalty. And it's super heartbreaking. And, you know, Achigo was actually ended up being adopted by a gardener who worked for the Ueno family. But, you know, he just kept returning to that train station on the clock for the remaining years of his life. So basically for another 10 years, kept going back. And died not too far away from the train station itself.
Oh,
and
there stop is, it, Karen,
right? That's the thing with pet stories. So Achigo, actually, there's a statue that I think that several of us have seen,
yes.
like visiting Tokyo before, mm-hmm. near the Shibuya station.
Yeah. I think my parents took a photo next to it like the other week.
It's totally like Instagram bait. Yeah. I feel like right now there's got to be 100,000. Yeah.
And so anyway, and that there was actually a movie made by Lasse Hallström, the great Swedish director who, you know, directed My Life as a Dog, but which transposed Achigo's story from Japan to some other place with Richard Gere and Joan Allen.
They whitewashed Achigo.
Totally whitewashed. And
of
it was just
course.
Like, Achi, yeah, hey, Achi, Tachi, what's up? So in any case, but I still cry every time I see the trailer. Every time I actually think about Achigo, this is the thing. I cried when I saw the commercials to Marley and Me, even though that was a terrible movie, which is the concept, the idea. I mean, like, I'm a sucker for anything related to, like, animal loyalty, longevity, and then ultimately death.
Did you see War Horse?
I did not see War Horse.
Dude, War Horse is a killer. I cried through half of that movie. Oh, and it was early on in my relationship with David, and I think he was like, okay, yeah, all right.
I saw a footnote that Achigo is now on display at the National Science Museum in Ueno, Tokyo. And I think they literally mean on display. Like, he's been taxidermied and he's sitting in the museum. That seems, I think, a statue, a bronze statue, yeah, absolutely. Like, the taxidermied remains of the dog, that just seems really a little perturbing to me.
It happens, though. I mean, for people, it's a way of keeping their loved ones around.
Right. I was going to joke that,
listening?
You know, if Achigo was a cat, like, would not give a fuck about the fact that the owner hasn't come back.
Yeah. And, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he'd be like, good.
Late, what else?
Right. So I do not want to get into the classic dog versus cat debates, though I think invariably we're going to have to touch upon this. But I was thinking about this in terms of the fact that really outside, I mean, there are more prominent dog movies than we can possibly, you know.
Bud, Benji, Air Bud. Yeah, like that. Yeah.
And then you think of like prominent cat movies. The first thing and the only thing that really came to mind was the Aristocats, the Disney film from the 1970s or 80s. And, you know, just recently I saw this trailer for A Dog's Purpose, which is an upcoming Dennis Quaid film, which is not just another talking dog movie, though it is, but it's a talking dog movie where the dog is constantly being reincarnated as new dogs, each a different breed with a different adventure. It's basically the most meta dog talking dog movie ever made.
As the years went by, I could tell my time with Ethan was coming to an end.
Good boy, Bailey. I'm gonna miss you.
And then it happened. I was back. I didn't have I'm a girl?
Good girl, good girl.
I had a new purpose. I was needed again. And again, and again.
Hi, you.
With each new life, I was learning a new lesson.
Hey,
have we met before?
And where are the great cat films like this? Why is it that, is there an anti-feline conspiracy? And Karen, you pointed out that cats sort of rule kind of the small screen, like obviously like videos and memes are all cat based.
New media platforms are owned by cats.
But dogs get the scripted dramas. So what's up with that?
I think it has to do with training. Dogs are easy
Absolutely.
To train and cats aren't.
That's
cats don't want to deal with your bullshit. They're I will not stand up on my two back legs for a treat. Fuck you. Mm-hmm. Whereas dogs are like, they'll do that all day. They love it. They want to please people, and cats don't really care about pleasing people that much, which is why we love them and why they are mysterious and beautiful. And I think, the internet is for cats.
Well, so unscripted, candid fare, where just like normal cat behaviors can be transposed easily into human behaviors. I'm thinking of Henri, a celebrity cat. Henri, the cat with ennui, the existentially troubled cat, which, you know, it's sort of like shot in black and white and sort of like he has in his French accent these dark thoughts about, like, you know, existence and, you know, philosophy and what have you.
Don't you think that Henri and Grumpy Cat would get along famously? They would just piss on each other?
Oh, I don't know about that. I feel like Henri and Grumpy Cat are from two different, like, worlds and class backgrounds.
But they're both like nihilists.
Well, I actually went to a cat video festival.
Oh, I saw
I'm that
yeah.
kind of crazy cat lady. Yes. Where at the Ace Hotel here in downtown LA. So that's it's not like I went to some like strange
right.
like,
you went to a classy joint.
I went to a classy joint and it was sold out. And there were a couple of celebrity cats there. I can't remember what the name of the one of Grumpy Cat wasn't there, but it was another cat. And, you know, the cat video festival consisted almost entirely of just kind of unscripted, like, YouTube videos of cats doing hilarious things. And, you know, whereas dogs, as you say, are more easily trained and can fit within the context of a narrative, some of the most amusing things about cats are their reactions and their reactiveness. And so, you know, basically, like, I think a third of the program consisted of cats, like, reacting to shit. You know, like,
they do have the best reaction shots. Like, I'd rather watch a live cam for an hour of cats walking around than dogs.
And the scripted dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite parts in Pixar's Inside Out was the very brief joke of looking inside the head of a cat and that there really is no rhyme or reason to it. It's just a bunch of crazy cats are all inside of a cat's head. Yeah. So I thought that sort of captured sort of an essence of felineness.
There is one classic cat movie, though. The Cat from Outer Space from 1978.
That trailer is rad.
He's the cat from outer space.
You're serious?
I'm serious.
While you and I are talking this very minute, some slimy, green-headed, 12-legged creep could be crawling into the White House.
You're trying to tell me that your little pussycat came from another planet, from another galaxy, in a spacecraft, and landed right here on Earth.
We're up against genius.
I gotta tell you something, pal. It's dumb. Very dumb.
And, you know, the thing is, like, I remember as a kid, they just kept showing us as a reward when we were in elementary school, the cat from outer space. And I'm like, why do they keep showing this freaking movie? But I, you know, I think it maybe like predisposed me to being like into cats, aside from the fact that also like being, yo, lesbian equals cat lady. But the cat from outer space was awesome.
Can I ask you guys a question about pets and gender?
Yeah.
When you guys were little, did you think that all cats were girls and all dogs were boys?
When you say little, you mean like as in yesterday? I've learned to be much better at catching myself with it. But for example, so my sister-in-law, who's we inherited her cat, who's Max, a male, but she used to have a chocolate lab named Fosse, rest in peace. And Fosse was a girl, but I always gendered Fosse male. I mean, partly because it's named after Bob Fosse, but I could just never remember that Fosse was female. And I think part of it is the gendering of the pets.
Yeah. Well, there was that controversy about Spuds McKenzie, you know, who
was
like,
Spuds a girl?
Spuds was really a girl. And of course they cast a girl dog because they don't want to see, you don't want to see Spuds' junk on a beer commercial. Right? Like, that's what, you know, like, more often than
Take
not,
that
they
shit
have,
down.
Like, female dogs. You know, but so, like, a lot of female dogs get more roles, and, you know, part because, you know, that's you don't have to deal with the appendages in a particular way.
And they don't mark their territory.
Exactly. Mm. But, you know, but, yeah, this gendering of animals, like, cats as girl, is feminine, and in fact, I think it might, part of that might have to do with actually different languages and the way, the words for cat and dog are gendered in those languages, like in Spanish or in German or what have you. So, I mean, I know that's a highfalutin answer for that, but...
No, but that I didn't think about it that way. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of when you were talking about cats and the description, some of what you were saying just has this gendered kind of read to it, you know? Like, you don't know what's in their heads. You never know what they're thinking. Like,
they're
that's
mysterious.
Kind of, right, they're
cats
mysterious.
Are from Venus.
Yes, cats are from Venus. Yeah. Dogs are from Mars.
Why is it that no one can seem to have a monkey as a pet and not seem a little bit crazy? Like, when's the last time there's a really normal, sane person with a monkey for a pet? I don't think there is one. I can't think of
only Ross from Friends had his pet monkey Marcel in the early seasons. Because, you know, he's like an anthropologist and
he
had proximity to monkeys.
But he at least had a scientific background.
Yeah. But, you know, Bubbles, right? That's one of the early signs of the...
That's what I'm talking about.
And the woman that had, like, a pet monkey that tore her face off or something, and everyone was like, serves you right. Do you remember that horror? I mean, okay. Just cut that. It's so horrible.
No, no, but wasn't she the one who got the face transplant because of that? Or maybe I'm confusing her with someone else.
That sounds like your next pitch, Oliver, too.
But what is it about having a monkey as a pet that just makes that person seem a little off?
It seems actually like not in keeping with the way we imagine people who work with monkeys in movies, like having being pretty cool, like, you know, Clint Eastwood in Any Which Way But Here and those movies
with
orangutan, right? Like that was cool. They had a cool collaboration. Or BJ and the Bear with that TV show from the 70s. Also with the like chimps were really big in the post Goodall era. But, you know, like,
can I just take a pause here and just say, I love the extent that Karen can actually think on this, because I'm just throwing some shit out there. Like, I have no idea. And Karen's like, yo, let me break
Karen's
this down
like
to you.
She's just like Coco the Gorilla.
The post-Gadal moment.
But the thing is, like, you know, well, pop culture represents a relationship with a chimp or a monkey in one way. And, like, when people have tried to transpose that into real life, and particularly celebrities, because let's face it, not that many other people have access to monkeys in other ways, then it always seems a little strange or sketchy. But I also don't think it toggled over to the sketchy until all the stuff happened with Bubbles.
Bubbles was the tipping point.
I think Bubbles was the tipping point, totally.
But I get really sad and freaked out by monkeys in movies that are sad. Like, when they do a zoom in on a monkey that's really sad about the world, like, that crushes me.
That's some Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, totally.
Because they are so close to us. So I'm like, it is me.
And there are so
it
many sad, like, all of the new Planet of the Apes films with, like,
I can't
real,
even watch them.
You know, and it's just sort of like, yeah, it's just, it's devastating. I can't, like, you know. Yeah. Anyway, obviously, whatever. I've always had a lot of exposure.
There's a lot there to unpack.
Pop culture with monkeys.
All right, last question. What domesticated animal, or an animal maybe hasn't been domesticated sufficiently, is waiting to be the next breakout sort of celebrity animal?
Ferrets. No, I'm lying. Ferrets are horrible.
I mean, goats sort of had that moment with the witch, right?
Yeah, I also feel like that baby goat, the pygmy goat video, that was like the little pygmy goat walking on the sidewalk next to that person. Like, I was like, you're going to be a star. And I
don't... As opposed to Berea. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what happened to that pygmy goat, but talk to me. All right, I can hook you up with some agents.
The next breakout animal, that's like asking what's the, you know, next big green veg after kale. You know, I don't really
there is
know.
None.
Watercress, actually.
Yeah, well, everybody talked about watercress and some other things. But in any case, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, well, there was... You know, the miniature horses and well, there's a whole thing where people were like,
we didn't even talk about horses.
Like little Sebastian from Parks and Rec.
Yes.
But also, though, like, I mean, there's also this period where people were like getting alpacas and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because of the TV commercials where it's like, raise an alpaca, make extra money.
Until they realize that they can spit on you.
Exactly. And are pretty violent. I mean, I think it's going to be like some kind of weird large bird.
You know, you just read my mind because I was just about to say that LA has a long history of ostrich farms in different parts of the city, and I feel like this is really untapped territory in
but
terms of there's no period drama set on ostrich farms. Like, what's up with that?
Have you ever been on an ostrich farm, though? Have you ever encountered an ostrich close up? Because it's scary as fuck.
Because they're big ass birds.
They're huge, and they're kind of like, I went to the ostrich farm near Silvang, which we were talking about recently before we started taping. And anyway, I went to this ostrich farm where you can feed the ostriches. First, they're like large, prehistoric seeming beasts, were incredibly fast. And then, like, they give you this little pan of like what looks like kibble. And you, like, kind of dangle your arm over this fence. And all of these ostriches just come, like, pecking at the pan in a really violent way. And I was just like, this is so Jurassic Park. I can't even handle this. Like, I'm just like, I don't want to even pay for another dish of food. Like, I don't even know why I'm here.
They do have great neckwear.
They do have
fluffy neckwear.
Absolutely.
But Flynn, like when we would walk, when I would walk him in Echo Park, and you know, there's geese walking around there.
Yeah.
Like he had several altercations with these geese.
There's a band of three mean white geese at white supremacist geese at Echo Park.
I think they prefer the term white nationalist.
Exactly.
Now.
One of them has a big
geese nationalist, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway. Yeah, yeah. I've had encounters with those geese too.
Yeah.
Anyway, obviously, I'm around animals too much.
Are we out of time? No
I think
way.
We're totally probably. Like, chatty chat. I mean, who knew? You brought me on. You didn't know like how deep.
No, we knew, Karen. We knew.
I knew.
Right away, we were like, Karen Tongson has to be part of this show.
No, this is definitely a joke that especially Karen can appreciate. But somewhere out there, there's a wing of people who are animal studies folks that in American studies who are listening to this. And they're either really happy or really pissed off at us right now. And
I'm sure they're totally pissed off.
I'm not sure which way it goes.
Especially because we confuse like gorillas, monkeys, primates. Right, like right. We just made a mess of that whole thing. Apologies.
And also, I'm wondering now in retrospect if I misgendered Hachiko. But like we'll figure it out.
Right. Mm. It does occur to me that
Us on the internet, please, yes. If you need to.
I mean, we really totally dropped the ball about horses and horse movies.
I said War Horse.
You did. Yeah. You did. But just in general, because that's a whole subgenre. That'll be a future Pop Rocket show is just dedicated to the our equine friends.
Yeah.
But also young adult books.
Yes.
Remember the books of your Black Stallion. Oh, of course. That's, Caitlin.
This is what I'm talking about.
But horses have this very strange, like, kind of status as a, like, you know, some sort of, like, erotic imago or something, right? Like
this
a horsey
is,
girl, like, you know, that there's. So there's
horses.
All of that
Next
kind
show.
Of dirty stuff related to horses.
Horse
so
and sex.
Being a horsey girl is, like, weird. Yeah.
Right. Let's talk about the phallic value of, like, the unicorn horn. We don't need to get into that. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this with our jams.
You're listening to Unicorn Rocket.
A Ty is a pedantic person. I think when he pronounces these words, it's in a very show-offy way. Gyro.
Yiro.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu.
Ayers Rock.
Uluru.
What you are witnessing is real. The participants are not actors. They are actual litigants with real cases. They call in via Skype to Judge John Hodgman's court, the real people's court. Now I call you to Judge John Hodgman's internet court. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum. And with me in the studio, we have
Margaret Wappler and Flynn Wappler Earl.
Yes.
And Karen Tongson.
And every week on the Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what is your current jam? Karen, you are our guest, so I'm going to throw to you first.
Okay, so my current jam is a song that I'm not even really sure I like. It's just an earworm, and it's something that I've heard so often on the radio. And honestly, I thought it was like maybe a Faith Hill, Tim McGraw, we're on tour together, like duet, but it isn't. So I'm just going to ask Kristen here to get it started.
Taking pictures of people we thought were stars. It's easy to get into your heart. When you're drunk on Lausanne Boulevard.
All right. So you can kind of see like, what's the song about being drunk on La Siena Boulevard? Because I'm also just like, there's not much shit on La Siena Boulevard. Like, if there's like a nightlife place, right?
No, so it's like, it's this like, is kind it's of... like how you get to the airport when
exactly.
you don't want to take the highway.
Or I mean, there's like, I guess Restaurant Row or something is rather. But in any case, it's not a place where you can like wander around and grab drinks. But I want to kind of like make sure to kick it back up to the chorus though. So one of the things I liked it was one of the reasons that I liked this song when I heard it. I was just like, this is so terrible. It's so cheesy. It has the geography of L.A. wrong. And then the chorus kicks in. And I'm just like, oh, my God, this is a great like karaoke chorus. But so I was really interested in that aspect of it. And also just like for a moment, it defamiliarized me from Los Angeles. It made me feel like, oh, this is what it feels like to be a visitor again, to like have this sort of, you know, fun. Lord, like we were up all night, we were dancing, we were like burning the matches through the ashes. And it made me feel super festive and like I wanted to like experience LA as a tourist. And it's a Kenny Chesney song featuring Pink. And I don't know anything about Kenny Chesney. All I know is that like, you know, whatever, Pink manages to class the song up to. But like, again, it's a great song to sing along to and to have and to experience vicarious feelings through and with.
I mean, that song definitely has like Southwest Airlines Special to Los Angeles, like written all over
right?
it.
Yeah.
But respect, respect. But like, whenever I hear Kenny Chesney, I always think about Ann Powers telling me once that she has never seen so many people have sex on the lawn as she did during a Kenny Chesney concert.
Maybe that's also why I was
that's
just
so
thinking.
Perturbing.
I know.
That's actually kind of the feel of the song. It's like we're, you
having
know,
sex
having sex on La Cienega, getting drunk and having sex on La Cienega Boulevard. I'm just like, awesome, rock on. I'm like flashing rock horns and singing along in my car.
This also makes me think of, you know, a playlist of songs that get Los Angeles wrong.
Yeah.
I feel like someone like our friend and recent MacArthur fellow, you know, Josh Kuhn could come up with an equivalent of Los Angeles plays itself instead of be like Los Angeles sings itself and all the ways in which songs completely get the geography of the city wrong.
Well, you so keep that idea this. And maybe you'll get the MacArthur Fellowship.
Okay.
There you go.
There we go.
We'll share it and maybe we can split one.
Give me a nibble. Give me a nibble.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll divvy it up.
Yeah.
For my song this week, I DJed a wedding this past weekend, and it was my first Pop Rocket referral. So these are Matt and Katie. So shout out to Matt and Katie. Who are Pop Rocket listeners, and it's the first time I've gotten hired to do a gig off of this show. And they picked, I always love just what first song couples pick, and they're always good. I mean, I don't know if I've ever heard a couple pick a bad one. If I did, I wouldn't say it publicly. But they chose a song which I'd never heard before, which is On the Front Porch, written by Burl Ives, though this version is sung by, I forget who does this version of it, but it's a Burl Ives song. It's called On the Front Porch. It is lovely. Let's take a listen to it.
Ooh, is linger here on the front porch with you. From the wicker swing.
I feel like I should have like a mason jar of something that with a little bit of bourbon
moonshine,
in it.
Yeah. Moonshine.
But yeah. It's very lovely and romantic, and it's a very perfect kind of first dance song. So shout out to Matt and Katie. Thank you for having me DJ your wedding and introducing me to a Burl Ives tune, which I hadn't heard before.
The Sherman Brothers.
So that was On the Front Porch by the Sherman Brothers, written originally by Burl Ives. And shout out to Matt and Katie for inviting me to DJ your wedding. Margaret, take us home.
I just want to say real quick that Burl Ives has a really great children's album.
I'm sure he does.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he has an amazing
voice. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, that whole soundtrack, right? Like all the Burl Ives Christmas stuff.
Yes, yes. But The Fantastic Mr. Fox, remember that Wes Anderson movie?
Yeah.
They used a couple of the Burl Ives songs in their soundtrack. It was very well deployed.
It's very pet-related, too.
There you go.
Yes. I picked Dolly Parton's Cracker Jack because Dolly Parton loves a good puppy song, and this is one of my favorites off of Jolene. So let's hear the story of Cracker Jack.
Billy couldn't eat no more. I took him to my room and put a blanket on the floor. After that, beside my bed is where he'd always sleep. Each night in my prayers, I'd pray the Lord his soul.
Good puppy dog name, right?
It is. We should ask, is Flynn into music? What are Flynn's jams? Does Flynn have jams?
Oh, man. I don't know. I'm going to have to find his jams, his soul jams, like what touches him deep inside. Let me get back to you on this for part two of Celebrity Animals.
Right.
My previous cat, who I had for 18 and a half years, she loved soft rock.
Really?
And so she'd like be really into, because it wasn't too
loud. I
feel
like cats are more opinionated about music.
Yeah. And then she was really like so anti like anything dancey or upbeat or housey. Like she was just like, wah! And then like, you know, it's like Phil Collins and she's like, you know, purring. And stuff
wow.
Like that. In the car, because I used to drive around. But
right.
Anyway.
Air Supply just really put that cat in the
Yeah, totally.
There you go.
Yeah, you can pretty much blast Slayer in Flynn's ears. And as long as you're making a smiley face at him, he's like, cool.
Did anyone see Dolly at the Hollywood? Back to Dolly. See Dolly at the Hollywood Bowl?
I've seen her in the past, and she's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was.
She like gets into this old rocking chair and tells stories, and like pretty much like knits in her lap as she sings. It's amazing.
Wow. Yeah. Maybe she has like that mason jar full of moonshine out there too.
She
totally
does.
We all went really kind of sort of variations on country this week, yes. I guess, right?
Something in
country
the
and pets. That's a third episode.
Because they're into domesticity, you know? Yeah. So many country songs are about just like being home.
Yeah.
With an old Yeller to have a dog.
That's right.
We didn't even talk about old Yeller and all the like the kind of dog movies that just devastated us.
Yeah, exactly. I'm too scarred from old Yeller.
Chimp eyes.
Where the red fern grows.
Yeah.
Anyways, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum, along with Margaret Wappler and our special guest, Karen Thompson. And Karen, just to remind our listeners, I mean, you've been here like a gazillion times, but where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Inland Emperor. And as I mentioned earlier, you can find my cats, Lily and Corky, on Instagram at Lily and Corky Show.
Amazing. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thank you for letting us use it. To So Smart, So Funny and Amanda T. Thompson for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. Thank you so much. If you haven't already, please, please review us. If you have an opinion that you want to share about this week's topics, your favorite pet movies, your favorite celebrity pets, whatever, you can join the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We're at Pop Rocket. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Christian Duenas, Daniel Barwella, and Kara Hart.
Awesome. You're so chill.
I know. Isn't he just like,
yeah.
Like, whatever, guys. Keep talking about my people.
Yeah.
All right. 3, 2, 1.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.